So, you know, I talked in previous shows, you should listen to them, about the unholy alliance between the progressive left, the communist left, which Barack Obama and Valerie Jarrett and Hillary Clinton, all those people are part of, and radical Islam. You just see it more and more and more every day. And now, of course, they are trying to cloak everything in climate change. So number one, let's talk internationally about climate change agreements. Not legislation, because he's not going to get that done, but agreements, semi-treaties, executive orders, EPA regulations. Let's talk about what that means. Did you know that the basis of the 150 nation plus or minus get together in Paris was to talk about how much money they were going to give the undeveloped countries to develop alternative energy? This is a huge wealth redistribution scam and control scam, folks. It doesn't have, you name the word, to Shiola, blank to Shiola, to do with climate change or any concern about your welfare or the welfare of your kids or future generations, as Barry would like to say. It is all about control. It is all about taxation, which Barry, by the way, had also admitted this week. He thought the most eloquent plan would be to come up with a new tax on carbon. Wouldn't you just like that coming out of your pocket? How much are you folks willing to pay, supposedly, to get a 0.002 reduction? That's 0.02% reduction in greenhouse gases of various types over the next decade or two. Two one-thousandths. You want to be kind and go with the most drastic predictions? Two one-hundredths. Some people say two ten-thousandths of a percent. And just so you know, in addition to giving away hundreds of billions of dollars to developing nations from the rich nations, because, you know, we're the nasty colonial powers, and all those poor little nations out there deserve our money. It's reparations. I use that word all the time. Reparations, redistribution, and social justice on the international level. That's what climate change is all about. And here at home, it's about control. Oh, yes, it is about control. Did you know that he got, it's so bad, that Barry actually got a letter from 626 Democratic, not progressive, these are the real Democrats, the Democrats that your dad and mom used to know, who are long gone, except that in some cases at the state and local levels, they're gone on the national level. All replaced by progressives. But 600 Democratic politicians from 32 states sent this huge letter to Obama. Let me read you part of it. As Democrats committed to a prosperous America and a healthy environment, we believe the United States has a unique opportunity to lead the world in addressing the global climate challenge. And yet to do so, as we must, we must do without unduly burdening the American economy or the American people. By the way, this coalition of all these Democrats from 32 states is called Coal Blue. That's C-O-A-L, Blue. You can look it up online. So it was signed by 626 state local officials, 36 states, 177 state legislators, 278 local elected officials, and 148 Democratic Party officials. And this is a report out of the Washington Examiner, by the way. And they had some really interesting, shall we say, statistical fodder in this letter, which, of course, Barry hasn't told you. Neither have any of the other climate change radicals. The letter goes on. I'll give you another paragraph. Unfortunately, the EPA's recently published rules for new and existing electric generating units severely miss the mark in many important regards. Taken together, they endanger the continued development of critical carbon mitigating technologies necessary to achieve sustainability, threaten the reliability of the U.S. power grid, and place significant economic burdens on the American economy and the American people in the form of higher energy costs and a potentially less reliable electric grid without achieving any meaningful reductions in global CO2 emissions. This is from his own party. Quote, the EPA, while well-intentioned, well, I would question that, has lost sight of the importance of preserving affordable and reliable energy in its pursuit of clean energy. So let me tell you, let me give you some stats here. So the EPA's Clean Power Plan, all caps, calls for a 30% reduction in CO2 emissions by 2030. Remember, China, supposedly, according to Obama, has signed on to this, but they don't have to begin reducing their emissions until 2030. So we reduce, we stick it up our own butts, we hurt our economy. China doesn't have to do anything until after we're kind of on the ground, bleeding. That's Barry's idea of a good deal. Should give you a lot of faith in the Iran deal, huh? So the energy resources that are going to be impacted the most by all this stuff are obviously coal and natural gas. And the U.S., folks, we still get 39% of our energy, that's almost 40%, from coal, and 27% from natural gas. Now, those two statistics together are 67%, two-thirds of our energy still comes from coal and natural gas. Now, think about what happens if you just take those out of the equation. Nothing good. 19% of our energy, by the way, is from nuclear. 6% is from hydroelectric, and 7% from other renewables, mostly wind power, which, by the way, is up 3 or 4% over the last 4 or 5 years. So, you know, the president already said in 2008, before he was elected, that his plans would necessarily cause electric rates to skyrocket. So that's nothing new. But the Heritage Foundation, they did a study last fall. And these are some interesting stats. They found those EPA regulations that these Democrats are complaining about, if it's going to really achieve their climate change goals, which are absolutely infinitesimal and don't mean squat if India and China aren't on board, and they're not, it would reduce the United States GDP, gross domestic product, by $2.5 trillion a year by the year 2030. I want you to think about that. Our GDP is only about $16 trillion. And employment levels would track 300,000 jobs below the no-carbon regulation baseline. In other words, you establish a baseline now before these regulations go into effect. 300,000 less jobs per year after the regulations are in effect. And as we all know, the job market sucks. Forget their unemployment rate. Go to realstatistics.com and take a look at it. It ranges anywhere from 8 to 42%, depending upon the minority, the sect, the area, the vocation, you name it. But it's at least 8%. Most places, it's about 11%. And they want to reduce employment. At the same time, they want to keep the borders open so that there's more and more people coming in looking for work. And at the same time, they piss and moan up on their podiums talking about how middle class wages have stagnated. Well, let's see. If you got less jobs and you got more people looking for jobs, what happens to what employers will pay for the jobs? I guess it goes down. Wow. 2 plus 2 is 4 and water runs downhill. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce did a study. They found the typical U.S. household, this is a big number, could lose $3,400, $3,400 in disposable income per year And if you put all those households together, by the year 2030, that costs this economy another $586 billion. That's B with a B, it's B, billion dollars. All of which exacerbates the economic adverse effect, because that's $586 billion that these folks don't have to put into stuff to buy, which runs the economy and creates jobs. As an aside, you know, there was a report yesterday. There was, you know, everybody's jumping up and down. There was like 300,000 new jobs, and this is wonderful, and blah, blah, blah. You know, folks, this is as obvious as the California terror attack in the first minute. This is as obvious as the Paris terror attack in the first second. Why were there so many jobs? Besides the fact the government probably cooked the books and they'll adjust it downwards later, which they do almost every month. Because it's Christmas. And what happens in Christmas? There's a lot more business, a lot more people running around in stores, and stores and other places like that have to hire people. And they normally can them in January. Wait till you see the unemployment figures and the new job figures at the end of January. Mark my words. The Institute for Energy Research said in its report on the EPA rules, I mean, I've just given you smidgens here, to use the president's word, just smidgens. The EPA regulations impose huge costs for small benefits. The agency's ozone rule could be the single costliest regulation in U.S. history. I think that kind of sums it up, doesn't it? So, redistribution of wealth within the borders of the United States, crony capitalism within the borders of the United States, more government control, and international wealth redistribution and reparations from the colonial powers to the poor developing nations to bribe them to have clean air. Makes you feel good. It's all warm and fuzzy. As long as your warmth doesn't come from any fossil fuels. Then we have this other little thing that's been flying under the radar. With Google, Apple, Microsoft, huge tech companies that employ hundreds of thousands, God knows how many millions, in indirect and ancillary jobs. And you know, the government is kind of all over these companies because they've come up with encrypted communications. Encrypted communications platforms. And the government, once again, using the safety of the American people, which they don't care about, as the pretext, as the guise, listen to my show last week, where I talked about the guise that these guys use on everything. So we want to keep the American people safe because we care about the American people. We want them to get to the polls and vote for us. And after that, you know, we don't really care. And we don't really care that much anyway, but, you know, we need to look good. So, this will be our guys. We want to keep the American people safe, and therefore, the government needs a back door to get into these encryption scripts. And I'm not a techie. But the government wants to be able to read the encrypted communications or get into the encrypted communication systems that Google and Apple and Microsoft and others have developed. Ironically, because the government is incapable of keeping us safe from hacking, to begin with. I mean, the whole thing is like a round robin. It's unbelievable. It's a conundrum. It's like, don't you feel like a rat in a big old toilet and somebody's hit the flusher and you're going round and round and round and round and round? And that's about how they view us, I might add. The rat in the toilet and the toilet bowl's been flushed. Anyway, the White House summoned all the chief executives from all these huge companies to Washington. Now, that's not normally the way it's done. Normally, you know, who's ever in charge of that policy would get on a plane and go meet with these guys. But they summoned them to Washington. And you know, the result of this is going to be, the result of this is going to be that a foreign competitor is going to start up a similar company that's completely free of U.S. influence in Brazil or Russia. And understand, you know, just as money goes where it's treated best and where it's safest, the same is true of privacy and security, folks, particularly if people are getting paid to provide privacy and security. And we're dead last in that regard. In fact, Microsoft has already opened a data center in Germany under the control of what's called a data trustee. European customers of Microsoft can keep their information in the cloud and therefore keep it hidden from the U.S. government. And the government can't do anything about it. Now, Bill Gates is a pretty smart guy. That's why he's worth about $20 billion or whatever he's worth. You don't think he has a team investigating moving Microsoft out of the United States? Really? So, anyway, the bottom line is putting it at a data trustee in a foreign country is number one, step one toward moving all a branch of or a wholly owned subsidiary out of the country. And number two, because under international law, a data trustee can't be touched by the United States government. Kind of tells you a lot about where we are. Which brings us to the next story. And this one is a big one. And how it's flown under the radar, who knows? But I'm sure it's not something that Obama wants to get out. So while all this other stuff's been going on, there's this currency called the SDR. The SDR, let me grab my little cheat sheet here. The SDR is kind of like the money of last resort. It's money that's issued by the International Monetary Fund. And the only time the fund has issued SDRs, which is kind of like, think of it as a dollar bill, something like a dollar bill, an SDR bill, and a percentage of it represents the yuan, and now it represents the yuan as of this week, a percentage of it represents the US dollar, a percentage the Japanese yen, and a percentage the euro, the European Union's money. Oh, and the British pound, too. Well, that SDR has only been printed three times in the last 50 years. Each time, it's been in conjunction with a crisis having to do with the U.S. dollar, particularly a crisis of confidence in the dollar. In 1969, France and other countries recognized that the United States was printing too many dollars. I mean, we've been talking about this for years on this show. And at the same time, foreigners like France could still exchange dollars for gold. And there was like a run on Fort Knox. Shortly thereafter was the Bretton Woods Agreement. Remember that? Remember all that stuff? I'm sorry, it wasn't the Bretton Woods Agreement. It was the agreement between Kissinger and the Saudi Arabian King. I'm thinking back to World War I because it was another segment I wanted to do on this radio show, but I'm not going to have time. And that is how all this that's going on right now resembles 1938. But that's for another show. So Kissinger, and I've talked about this on previous shows, did a deal with Saudi Arabia. The United States will protect you, but you got to do all your oil transactions in dollars. Therefore, the petrodollar was born. The British pound fell out of world reserve currency status. The dollar took over, and we've enjoyed all our pretend prosperity because we can print dollars, we can buy our own bonds, etc., because we're the world's reserve currency. And we're in that basket of currencies. There were just four up to this week that represents SDRs. So in 1969, when there was this run on gold, the IMF created the SDR to kind of smooth out the monetary seas. and they issued 9.3 billion SDRs through 1972 when we went off the gold standard. And we made the deal with Saudi Arabia and OPEC on the euro, on the petrodollar. In 1979, U.S. inflation was crazy. I don't know if many of you might remember it. I do. 14% inflation. 14%. I mean, that's rocking. And the value of dollars that were held by oil-producing countries, once again, Saudi Arabia, those guys, etc., was going down. Because what is inflation? We've talked about this. It is not the increase in the value of goods and services, it's the decrease in value of the purchasing agent. So Saudi Arabia was selling its oil and getting paid cheaper and cheaper and cheaper dollars. And the whole agreement that had been made a little bit under 10 years before was about to fall through. So the IMF stepped in and they printed 12.1 billion SDRs from 1979 through 1981. And if you remember back then, we had huge inflation and high interest rates. I mean, mortgage rates were like 18%, etc. And then again in 2009, remember we had the meltdown in 2008, the IMF issued 182.7 billion SDRs. In August and September. That's when the real meltdown occurred, if you remember. Just a few months before the election. So the SDRs are the money of last resort. Now, for the yuan to be admitted into the SDR gives China automatic economic superpower status, automatically accelerates the erosion of the dollar and the value of the dollar. And here's a really interesting thing. They could not have been admitted unless approved by the United States. You can't be admitted to the basket of currencies unless you are approved by a supermajority, or it might even be unanimous, I don't have that fact, of the countries who have the currencies who are in the basket of the SDR denomination. Japan, Europe, United States, and Britain. So here we have the United States agreeing to cut its own dollar throat by allowing the yuan to become part of the SDR, the world's money of last resort. There's a guy by the name Jim Rickards, excellent, you know, on the right side economist. A lot of people snigger at his theories, but he's been proven right time and time again. And what he says about this is, the next panic will be bigger than the central bank's ability to put out the fire. The only source of bailout cash will be the SDR. But a massive issuance of SDRs will require cooperation by China. The rush to include China in the SDR should be seen as the global monetary elites getting their ducks in a row before the next panic comes to destroy your portfolio. He's talking to investors. When that panic arrives, the IMF will issue trillions of SDRs. China will proceed to dump its dollars for SDRs. And the result will reduce the dollar to the status of a local currency no different than the Mexican peso. Unquote. So do you kind of see how important this was this week, and it wasn't covered at all? Zero. Zero. Now, the U.S. dollar, even with China in the SDR pool, is still 41.73% of each SDR currency unit issued. And I hope I'm not boring you. This is really important stuff. I mean, this affects your pocketbook like you can't believe. And the financial stability and your security and your safety and that of your family. Okay? China, who wasn't in the SDR before this week, has 10.92% of each currency unit. The British pound sunk to 8.09%. The Japanese yen sunk to 8.33%. And the euro sunk to 30.93%. The euro had the biggest whack, by the way. So the dollar, obviously, is still the dominant currency in the basket of the SDR denomination. But it's being reduced significantly. And I think what Jim Rickard had to say, which I just read to you in part, is right on. By the way, as a little aside on that global warming deal, one of the things the nations agreed to is that they need to implement taxes and other incentives and disincentives so people eat less meat. Because, you know, meat really contributes to climate change. Did you know that? You know, that cow flatulence. Now, anybody knows anything about livestock or knows anything about science and who gives a damn would know that livestock, if they're not in the modern industrialized feedlot, actually limit carbon. There's a guy by the name of Brad Lemley. Don't take it from me. Take it from an expert. He writes the laissez-faire letter. So, contrary to what this University of Glasgow and Chatham House study that was being tatoed in Paris, that claimed, quote, our appetite for meat is a major driver of climate change, Brad Lemley puts it in common sense terms that a Wyoming boy can understand. Quote, each time a cow takes a step, its sharp hooves push grass, which is primarily made up of carbon pulled from the atmosphere and into the soil. Cattle manure does the same thing. In other words, via two mechanisms, cattle fix free carbon, a greenhouse gas, in the earth's crust. This means that intelligent grazing practices can take us back to pre-industrial CO2 levels and still feed people. There's a guy, by the way, who's a well-known biologist, Alan Savory. His research shows the same. And he concludes his whole big treatise let me give you five words. Quote, only livestock can save us, unquote. So, yeah, I just thought you'd be interested in that. I might have to take that part of the show and clip it and give it to all my cattle rancher friends. So, this brings me to the last part of this show. And that is how to take care of this terror problem in the United States. I mean, besides getting rid of all the progressives who are treasonous sympathizers at the best, with the enemy, at the worst, aiding and abetting the enemy while they lie to us. And number two, vaporizing ISIS over in the Mideast by whatever means necessary. Number three, we don't need gun control, folks. We need a law in the books kind of similar to Israel, kind of similar to Switzerland, both of which have very, very, very low crime rates. And other than Islamic extremism in Israel, very low crime rates and murder rates, etc. And gun-related violence. We need to mandate that every person in the United States, age 16 or older, without a criminal record, after passing a mental background, you know, I mean, do it right, needs to be trained in the use of firearms, both sidearms and long guns, and mandated by law to own a firearm of their choice. It can be a revolver, it can be a semi-automatic pistol, it can be a bolt-action rifle, it doesn't matter. They have to own a weapon. Now, once they own the weapon, you know, if they're averse to guns, they've been trained in them, they understand them, that might help them a little bit with their understanding of why gun control is such a bad idea, and it is on many levels. But you know, a fair number of people will carry them. And something tells me that if there's 200 million people armed, and I mean with the arms on them, going to their meetings, going to their restaurants, in the subway, on the trains, in the planes, and maybe the planes you got to be a little careful of because a bullet through the fuselage can have bad effects, but you get my point. At the football stadium, at the dance hall, at the Center for Disabled in California, at the Christmas party, you know what I think? I think there'll be a lot less terror attacks. And if there is a terror attack, I think it's going to last like about 3 seconds. So that is what this poor little old Wyoming hayseed would do to curb terror in the United States. Arm the citizens and train the citizens in the use of arms, as the Second Amendment of the Constitution of this country provides. And if the jihadis want to try it then, come on, baby. If Obama can't kill him over there, I guess the citizens can kill him here. That's a thought. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Thanks for listening. You have a happy and safe week, and we'll talk to you next Saturday.
For more information about Reed and his work, please click on the globe in front of you on the WebTalkRadio.net page. You can also click on the first two volumes of his number one best-selling historical Western series, Threads West, An American Saga, and the newly released second book, Maps of Fate. And on June 26th, the first volume of his new nonfiction book, Land, for Love and Money, will be available everywhere. Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archives on Reed's WebTalkRadio.net page, and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.